Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix, and I think you're really going to like the show today. We're at the Las Vegas Summer League this week, where we catch up with Wes Wilcox, the general manager of the Atlanta Hawks, who takes us behind the controversial decision to sign Dwight Howard. Tim Bontemps of the Washington Post stops by, and we discuss what we saw from number one pick Ben Simmons and other Summer League surprises. That's next on the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
Yahoo Sports presents the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix, powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your host, Chris Mannix.
Welcome back. Another episode of the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. We are here on the concourse of the Thomas and Mack Center, NBA Summer League. And I'm joined by a guy, maybe one of the few guys in the NBA, who has more Marriott points than I do, Wes Wilcox, the general manager and former advanced scout. General manager Atlanta Hawks, former advanced scout for many different teams here. Do you have, how many Marriott points at one point did you have?
You know, I don't know. I definitely, there was a point where I wanted to get over a million. And I think I did, but then I realized that might actually be a negative and not a positive. But the one thing I will say about Marriott is I like to say, you know, I'm going to be the 1% of the 1% in one thing and one thing only. And I don't know this to be true, of course. But I hit lifetime platinum at Marriott at 33 years old. And so that basically means 10 consecutive years of platinum status. And so I venture to guess that, you know, that's my 1% of the 1%.
So you're like George Clooney up in the air of right. of Marriott. Did you have like the head of Marriott come out and like shake your hand at 33 after 10 years to have a lifetime?
I'm disappointed they didn't, actually. But no, I did not. I don't even know if I have the card. Ironically, I don't stay at very many Marriotts anymore.
You've upgraded.
You've got
you know, JW Marriott now. Yeah,
that's right, the JW.
You people don't understand how grueling your former job is advanced guys on the road. I mean, we as reporters, we, you know, gripe sometimes about every other day traveling. You guys, I mean, when it was at its apex there for travel, what was your schedule like?
Yeah, so my longest trip, my hardest trip was 28 games in 29 days, and I believe it was 28 cities. And, you know, there's a bunch of guys grinding still on the road. There's guys on the road doing the advanced job that were still there when you and I really were. You were a young reporter. I was a young advanced guy. And there's guys that are still doing it to this day. And that's 12, 15 years ago. So it's talk about respect. You know, there's so many guys out there who are working every day in the, you know, from October to April, just grinding for a living. And you know, it teaches you the league at a pretty unique level.
What was your breaking point, though? Was there ever, like, you say the 29 days, 28 games. Was there a point in the last 10 years where you were just in a hotel room in, like, Minneapolis, and you're like, you know what? I'm done. I'm going back to wherever and working at whatever but this.
No, there really wasn't. Maybe I'm sick, but I just love this NBA so much. And the challenge of the NBA every day to get up and to grind and to work at it. And really, this job is the same. You know, it's just a different, you know, it's just a different set of responsibilities. But, you know, there's so many guys out there that I have so much respect for. And whoever comes across, whoever you meet along the way now that said they did advance, you know, you immediately have respect for them. The video guys, you immediately have respect for because of how long and how hard they work and how tireless and really thankless that job is. One of the things about the advanced job that people don't realize is how lonely it is. You know, it's a click and a send, and then you're off to the next, you know, to the next airport, to the next city, and you're watching your film and prep, and it can be a really lonely job. You know, we would all joke, the advanced guys, you know, you don't really talk to anybody, you know, that you have a real relationship with until about, you know, 35 minutes before the start of a game. As soon as the game ends, you're done. But it's really a brotherhood out there. And I think the job's changed just because these, really it's seats. You know, these seats are not quite what we used to get. We used to go sit courtside and watch Lawrence Frank yell and scream plays back in the Prudential Center in New Jersey, where now those seats are no longer there for advanced guys, and the seats are harder to get.
Yeah, a couple things. You are sick because you never really complained about the job, even when I knew you back then. You never complained, and you were always wanting to talk basketball, which, you know, you're a junkie.
It's kind of like you.
Yeah, I mean, but you were even worse. Like, you were, like, even when I get you on the phone sometimes, it'd be, you know, I'd have one question, it would turn into like this. We'd both be back and forth on a 15, 20-minute conversation about the topic that wasn't even the topic at that time. But you're right about the changing of the seat. This is kind of like inside basketball for people that are listening that don't really know what we're talking about. But the advanced guys and media used to have seats right on the floor. Nowadays, those seats have been backed off.
Yeah.
As an executive now, when advanced guys file their stuff, can you give it the same weight anymore? I mean, are they still able to do their jobs, I guess, is the question I'm asking.
Yeah, the job's changing, you know, in video technology, HD, you know, the audio is so much better now. The job is certainly changing. It's evolving. And some teams have gone away from the advanced guys, which in some ways is kind of sad. You know, we now in Atlanta use a bunch of regional guys. We don't have like a full-time advanced guy. No, our video room, they'll go in advance, specifically in the region. You know, they'll get on planes. And so we still do it. We still believe in it. It's still a really important part of our prep. But, yeah, the seats are further away. The seats are harder to get. And now it's interesting because I'll meet with our business guys, and I'm part of the group that's making the difficult decisions about where we do put the advanced scouts. And now some of these guys who are still on the road who I was doing it with, they'll text me. They'll be like, man, can you get a seat? Have you forgotten about us? And so it's really, I think, you know, it's hard because you just got to say, man, I'll do what I can. And I've actually offered my tickets to guys to try to help upgrade their seats along the way. And you know, the job's changing, but the whole NBA is changing.
Yeah.
And I think we're always trying to find ways to do our jobs differently, more efficiently, and the advanced job is really no different.
All right, well, now that the thousands of people listening that came to hear about Dwight Howard and the Atlanta Hawks are now have reason to listen right now. But talk to me about Dwight Howard and the decision-making there. When did sort of the idea sort of form in the mind of you, of Mike Budenholzer, to go after Dwight Howard, and what was the research like about to get him?
Yeah, you know, I think like every team, we're no different. Just looking at that free agent list every year, years in advance, and trying to find opportunities to add to your team. And along the way, you just do a great deal of background and a great deal of research on everybody. You're just trying to figure out, you know, what motivates guys, you know, what are they like inside a locker room, where are they at in their careers. And so when we were looking through the list, you know, and we had met with Dwight back in 2013, it was a little different group at the time, but still our interest was legitimate, it was genuine. And, you know, Dwight said it, I think we said it, like the organization probably wasn't in the right place for Dwight at the time, and Dwight wasn't in the place to come home. Though we had a lot of really good stuff going on, but like it was Bud's first year as a coach. You know, we hadn't won 60 games. We hadn't gone to the conference finals. And so, you know, since we've done some of those things, I think the timing made sense this time. You know, we've established ourselves, I think, as, you know, a really good program, a solid program. And so it just felt like it was the right time to see if we couldn't bring Dwight home. We met with him on Buckhead, you know, mid-morning on July 1st. We're fortunate he lives in Atlanta, so it could happen very quickly. And after that meeting, you know, according to Dwight and his agent, he told Perry that he didn't want to meet with anyone else. And he had other meetings scheduled and said, let's try to get to a deal in Atlanta.
Was there something that you and that Mike wanted to hear from Dwight in that meeting that you ultimately did hear, whether it was about where he's at mentally at this stage of his career, about what he can still be, his something else? I mean, was there something you guys wanted to hear?
Yes, but I think it's the same for any player we meet with. You know, we're looking for the same things. We're looking for guys who want to be a part of a team. Dwight said he wanted to be a part of a team. You know, obviously Dwight the player is Dwight the player. But, you know, we wanted, like, he talked about his desire, you know, to be held accountable, his desire to be, in a locker room where, you know, he wanted to be one of the guys. And so when those things came across authentically, he showed a great deal of humility. We just thought that that confirmed, I think, what we had heard throughout the league, that in his core, he's a really good person. You know him. I'm sure you've talked to him many times. He's funny as hell. You know, I think sometimes he's been beaten up for that. But, you know, we're ready to embrace him. We think he can be great in our stuff. We haven't had that presence at the rim on either end of the court. So we're going to play a little bit differently. But, you know, I know our coaches are really excited about, you know, making Dwight a part of our team. And I think Dwight is really excited about being a part of our team. And because of that, it just seems like it's the right time for both.
Yeah, look, I've said and I've even tweeted and written that the Dwight vitriol astounds me sometimes. Like the animosity directed towards him. Now, some of it, look, he's brought it upon himself at times with some of his public comments, but at his core, he is still a guy, a rare, when healthy, top five pure center in the NBA. And those guys don't grow on trees. They're not that. The one question I did have on Dwight, maybe you can shed some light on what you learned about this, that I think he's has the potential to be one of the best supporting players in the NBA. I think he can be a number two or a 1A type of guy on a championship team. I don't think, and this isn't a giant revelation, that he's the Dwight from 09 from Orlando just because of age, injury, and a wide variety of things. What did you view him as when you signed him? And does he have that mindset where he has to be the guy on this team?
If there was a word that I think has been shared on both sides, it's been team. You know, Dwight wants to be a part of a team. We've made it very clear we are a team. You know, we're not a team that has or historically has had like a top five guy. And so we've had to do it differently. And so we've done it with just a collection of depth across the board. And we've been fortunate, you know, to acquire some guys and then help develop some guys that have really helped our group. You know, and so really, I don't think we have like expectations about like this guy's the best player, this guy's the second best player, this guy's the third best player. I think our group is like, how good can we make this group of players to be the best team we can possibly be? And I know it's like people, I think, get tired of hearing that, but it's the truth. Like when we go to work every day, we just say to ourselves, and this is Bud to the coaches, this is to the front office staff, we just try to do the best job we can that day. We just try to get it a little bit better, make the best decision we can that day. People have asked me countless times, what's your strategy? We just want to make the next good decision. That's the strategy. And so that's player procurement. You know, that's whatever it is in trade, whatever it is in free agent signing, whatever it may be in draft, you know, whatever it is in scouting internationally. You know, we're just trying to make good decisions along the way, bring in good players. And we're so fortunate to have this coaching staff that is, like, very, very high level. Mike Budenholzer is incredible. He's proven. He's so established. And we have a great crew of assistants that have helped so many players improve. Like, one of the things we're talking about is, you know, Paul Millsap has become a three-time All-Star in Atlanta. Now, Paul should get a ton of credit. But it was the right match, you know, to in our system with our players. And then we think we've helped him improve. Kyle Korver, the same thing. Kyle Korver's, you know, solidified himself as a four-year starter. Jeff Teague improved with us. Dennis Schroeder's improved. Kent Bazemore, most recently, you know, shows significant growth. And we just think it's where it all aligns. You get the right people, the right players who want to work really hard. You coach them well, and then you put them in a great system. You hold everybody accountable. You play as a team, and this great stuff happens. So, you know, it's just kind of a unique thing that we just try to make good decisions after good decisions. We don't get them all right. You know, try to move on from the ones that we, you know, get wrong and just focus on trying to make the next best decision we can make.
I wondered when your season ended how it did with the four-game sweep to Cleveland, if you guys were going to, you know, maybe reboot the whole thing, if you were going to make trades. You know, you ultimately did trade Teague, but I did wonder if you were going to let Al go, maybe trade Paul, and maybe go in a rebuilding type of direction. If you felt that, and I didn't know, I just wondered if you felt that you had maximized that kind of group and were ready to tear it down and go in a different direction. What were the internal discussions about, you know, kind of what direction to go at the end of the season?
You know, I think like everyone in this seat is constantly juggling multiple paths at the same time. And, you know, I think we've all studied the models, you know, the superstar model versus the full rebuild versus maybe a hybrid of the two. You know, we've kind of called our stuff over the years this middle build, you know, try to do it through the middle. You know, one of the challenges about being really bad is you make mistakes across the draft. You make mistakes at the top, you make mistakes at the bottom, you make mistakes in the middle. And there's no guarantee, like, you know, we would say, you know, there's no guarantee you're going to get the number one pick. There's no guarantee you're going to get the number one pick right. There's no guarantee the number one pick is going to be like a franchise guy. And so there's so much unknown, and with so many really great players being drafted all across the draft. You know, and Paul Millsap was drafted, I think, 48.
Yeah.
Kyle Korver in the 50s. you know, Draymond, like, you know, and who's to say that, you know, I'm not here to say we're going to make those picks. We're certainly going to do our absolutely best to make picks of that caliber. But there's so many good players across the board that our view is you got to be good in all three. You got to be good in the draft, you got to be good in free agency, and you got to be good in trade. And just do the absolute best job we can and see how it plays out. Mm-hmm. So, you know, do we look at paths all the time? Are we looking at 18, 19, 20 right now? Absolutely. But how to get there and how to be the best team you can be, you know, I think it's our view that, like, just one approach isn't necessarily the right approach. And so for us, we just try to be good in all three. We're going to try to function in free agency next summer. We're going to try to function in the, you know, obviously everyone functions in the draft. And we've been really protective of our future. Maybe more so, like, I may frustrate Bud at times because I'm so protective of the future. You know, but we got all our first-round picks. We have another future first-round pick coming. We have all of our second-round picks and three future second-round picks coming. And so being really protective of that while trying to make this team as good as we can possibly make it is the balance that we've tried to walk. And, you know, we'll see how this year plays out. But, you know, once again, we're just going to, you know, lace it up, try to be as good as we can be, and see if we can't make the next best decision we can make.
The draft's what it comes down to, though. I mean, you know, San Antonio might not be San Antonio if they didn't find Kawhi Leonard, weren't able to mine him in exchange for George Hill in that draft. I mean, you know, you've got the same situation. You've got guys like Torian Prince, you know, guys drafted kind of in the middle part of the draft. You know, how important are those guys, like making sure those picks hit? How much pressure, I guess, do you feel as the chief executive there in making those picks happen?
Yeah, I mean, I would say a lot of pressure. You know, we, like every NBA team, you know, we're constantly working, trying to get all of those decisions to be as good as they possibly can be. You know, we lose sleep at night, you know, on trying to figure out who, you know, who are we going to select with what we have. But I think a big part of that is the player development element. I've been super fortunate to work with a number of people who have been in San Antonio, and they've made some incredible draft picks, but they've also drafted those players and then developed those players. And so I think that's where our focus is. Let's make the best pick we think we can make at the time, get him in our program, and then develop him to make that player as good as he can possibly be. And then we'll just see how it plays out. But, like, we feel great about this draft. Torian Prince has been able to play three summer league games, you know, since this trade is closed. He's shown some really, you know, I think he's shown that he has a future in the NBA. Certainly there's things to work on. He's willing to work. He plays really hard. He's super competitive. We love what we've seen so far. And DeAndre Bembry has done the same. We think DeAndre's got a chance to be a really nice player. Such a high IQ, such a great passer, unselfish to his core. You know, two guys that we think are really good Hawks fits. And then we drafted a young kid at 44, Isaiah Cordonnier from France.
How long did it take you to pronounce that name?
So I drafted two basically different – we drafted two different players. On draft night, I called him Isaiah Cordonnier, I think. And then by the next morning at the press conference, he was Isaiah Cordonnier. So people think – if they're listening closely – I think they might have thought we made a switch from draft night to the day after. But it took a while. But we're really excited about Isaiah. You know, chances are he's going to go back to France, play in Pro A. I think his club, he's going to be in the south of France. So a lot of scouting trips to Monaco.
That's tough for you.
Yeah, south French Riviera.
That's tough.
It's tough. Makes up for those advances.
Yeah, you might bring family members there. Who knows? Who knows? You know.
Hey, bud, I got to stay again. Like he's. I got to have dinner three nights from now because it's the only time they can do it. But in all seriousness, we're excited about his. You know, he's a super young player, who you know we're really excited about just to watch him grow. So, but as you say, the draft is critically important to everything all of us do.
You made a decision, a big decision, as an organization to move on from Jeff Teague, a guy that's been a big part of what you've done over the last 6-7 years. Was a decision based on the fact that Jeff was probably at his most marketable right now because of that full year on his contract, or, and I'm sure it's probably a little bit of both, but, you know, Dennis, what you saw from Dennis and his readiness to assume what really is the most important role in the NBA right now, given how many great point guards are out there?
Yeah, you know, I would say there are a lot of factors that went into decisions of this magnitude, and certainly Jeff gave us an incredible 7 years, and Jeff is, anyone who's been with Jeff knows he's a tremendous kid, tremendous person. I say kid, he's a man. He's got a great family. We're going to miss Jeff. But ultimately, you know, it really came down to the fact that we have two guys that both deserve to play a lot of minutes. And I think they were, you know, in some ways maybe taken away from each other. Though, you know, we look at our team and we say that was a strength of our team. You know, we basically had a starting point guard in the game for the large part of 48 minutes. But in a lot of ways, you know, going back to, you know, the trade deadline, we had Shelvin, or really a year ago, Shelvin Mack was, he's a very good backup point guard who we signed to a contract a couple of years ago, who, you know, we love Shelvin Mack. And it just got to the point where Dennis and Jeff were so good and playing so many minutes that Shelvin couldn't get in the game. And so, you know, working with Shelvin's agent, you know, Doug Newstead was fantastic. We found a home for Shelvin, and Shelvin played great for Utah second half of the year. And so it's not dissimilar, really. You know, both guys needed to play a lot of minutes, and I think they were both taken away from each other. Tough decisions made. But ultimately, we feel good. We don't feel good that we have to play against Jeff four times a year, or maybe three times a year at Indiana. But, you know, we're pretty confident that Jeff's at a place he wants to be. It's home for him in Indianapolis. And it was a deal that just made sense for both. And, you know, we'll see how it plays out.
Kent Bazemore was expected to get a big contract. He did get a big contract. You know, just kind of the going rate these days for guys his age and at that position. But I'm curious, how much did you guys talk internally about the dangers of bringing a guy, you know, a good player like Bazemore and making that kind of money into a locker room where his teammates, his peers are making significantly less? In other words, is there a danger of salary envy, salary jealousy in a locker room like that?
Yes, everyone, you know, we consider that. But I think every team has to consider it. And this is where, you know, the character of your group is really important. And I don't know that it's going to be easy for any team, or our team for that matter. But what I do know is Kent has a great deal of respect in our locker room for how hard he works, how professional he is. And I think a lot of players in the NBA right now realize that they got to take their time, and their time's coming. And, you know, I think we embrace that. You know, we said this to Kent. I said it to Kent. Kent, we want to do another deal. Austin Walton's his agent. Austin, we want to do another deal. And we say that to all our guys. Like, you know, our hope is that we're able to keep them. Our hope is we're able to find common ground. But the NBA is a super competitive world. We're all trying to figure out how to navigate the salary cap right now. And if, you know, our hope is that we help these guys improve. And then, you know, hopefully there's a home in Atlanta. And if there's not, that's just the NBA. And we try to figure it out. We keep moving, and we love the guys that move on. You know, we had to make a really tough decision 2 years ago with Damari. You know, we would have loved to keep Damari, and the numbers just didn't work. And so we gave Damari a giant hug. We said congratulations, and we couldn't be happier for him, though we wish we would have been able to figure it out. But I think this is just the NBA that we currently live in, and that's why developing your young players, your player procurement or scouting process is critical. The draft is critical, and that's why we're working. You know, but our hope is we can always keep our guys. And then the locker room part, I think if you have character in that locker room, you have professionalism, your guys work really hard. You know, I don't know if any of us, if they're going to love it, but I think they're going to respect it.
You mentioned Damari and losing him and just the financial reality of that. Was losing Al a similar situation, or were there differences in that particular deal?
You know, I'd prefer to stay away from, you know, those kind of private conversations between us and Al and his representatives. You know, again, great professional, 9 incredible years. And, you know, we've looked at this. You know, players going into their third contract at the level of Al, it's hard to keep those guys. And so, you know, we had a lot of conversations. Ultimately, it didn't work out. Al decided to move on. You know, we respect it. We're going to miss him. But we also feel really good about Dwight and the summer that we've had and the front line we have. You know, Paul Millsap's an incredible player. Paul Millsap's going to be, you know, has the option of being a free agent next summer. We have great respect for Paul. All he's done, 3-time All-Star in Atlanta. And, you know, I think our hope is that we get a deal done with Paul next summer, and we understand the market is going to be what the market's going to be. But at the end of the day, we have great deal of respect for Al, but we feel great about the summer. That
you obviously tried to keep Al, and I'm curious, from a basketball sense, did you believe that Dwight, Al, Paul, and Kent could form a strong rotation in that front court?
I would say that we looked at the roster as creatively as we've ever looked at it in any time that I've ever seen it. And we threw a lot of stuff on the board as, you know, what's the best team we can put together, even though it may be kind of counter NBA. And so we were juggling all sorts of stuff at the time. A lot of stuff's been reported. A lot of it's been, you know, as it is, I would say very partially accurate or inaccurate.
Not at the Vertical, though.
Not at the Vertical. Okay. You guys are, like, you know, I told...
Dead on.
Woj was the one that told me I got my job.
Hey, all right. There you go.
So that's the truth, by the way. But, you know, I think we looked at it this year probably as creatively as ever for us in Atlanta. And ultimately, it just played out the way it did. And again, we feel great about it.
When you look at the next couple of years as you're trying to figure out your plan for building a team, the cap's going to go up again next year, but then eventually it all kind of levels off. How aware are you as you're building this roster of the fact that, you know, these free spending days, to some degree, they're going to continue, but at some point, you know, that cap stops going up and you have to fill out a roster with key players there?
Yeah, you know, we're looking at 18-19 and the normalization of this cap at a very high level. And I think every team is doing the same. I would imagine every team is doing the same. We're doing our own internal calculations. You know, the league helps us out with a lot of those kind of projections. And, you know, and it's the constant battle between maybe management and coaching. You know, how do we build the best team we can build now while having an eye towards the future? And there's a lot of unknown. There's a lot of uncertainty. But, you know, we're fortunate. Our books are relatively, I would say, clean into the future. That's going to change, I presume. And, you know, one of I would say, the core philosophical approaches for our team-building approach has been one of flexibility. And, you know, we've said going into this summer that maybe flexibility is less valuable this summer and maybe next summer, maybe even in 18 than before. You know, I think we'd love to be locked up on, you know, 15 money, you know, long term. But that's also just a cycle. That's going to change too. And so, you know, there's opportunity in flexibility. And, you know, we'll deal with it again most likely next summer. We'll try to improve our team next summer. But we're certainly trying to figure out, you know, how do these contracts look 2 years from now when maybe the cap jumps a couple million and not 24.
When you're looking at your team right now and the expectations you guys have for it going into next season, I mean, everybody says we're going to win a championship. We want to win a championship. That's the goal of every team in the NBA. But as you're kind of adding and subtracting and layering in young players like the guys you have here at Summer League, what expectations do you guys have for this coming season?
You know, I think we're going to be a good team, but our expectations are that, like, the same every day. We just want to be the best team we can be. If you ask the question to Bud, I think he would almost answer it, you know, very similarly. Like, you know, we're going to expect to play hard. We're going to expect to play unselfish. We're going to expect to play like the Hawks play. You know, we're going to have our bumps in the road. We think we're going to be a really good team. But our focus is really on the process and approach and practice and player development, making our guys as good as they can be, playing unselfish, and then let the chips fall where they may. And if we do those things well, then we think we're going to win games. And then we think we can be have another really successful year. But in terms of going into the year with this is what we hope to accomplish, I don't think that's really ever been the way we do stuff. And so I don't think that's going to be the way we approach this year.
Just lastly, about circle it back to Dwight for a second. When guys go home, it's not always the best thing. Sometimes it can be. Yeah. But then you saw a guy like Kevin Durant who really didn't want any part of going back home and all that kind of comes with it. And when you were evaluating Dwight and the idea of bringing him home, how much did it concern you, if at all, about being home and around people you grew up with and that sort of atmosphere?
You know, I think these are really hard to quantify. You know, certainly Cleveland has a player that has come home and has helped him. He's pretty unique. I mean, six straight NBA
Who's that?
Finals, I think.
Who's that? Yeah, yeah, I forgot.
I don't think we're supposed to talk about other teams.
He's not on your team. Yeah. You can't say his name.
Yeah, and there's no expectation that that's what Dwight's going to do for the Hawks. But, you know, when we look at this, we with our new kind of leadership in Tony Ressler and Grant Hill, Steve Koonin on the business side, Bud on the basketball side, and the city of Atlanta being an incredible market, and anyone, you know, there are tons of former players who live in Atlanta in the off season, and we've broken ground on a brand new 90,000 square foot practice facility that's going to have our Emory Healthcare docs sports medicine team co-located on the facility. P3 and Dr. Marcus Elliott is moving his first expansion out of Santa Barbara into Atlanta, be co-located.
You got them to
practice.
Move out of Santa Barbara? How'd you pull that off?
They're staying in Santa Barbara.
Oh, okay. Yeah, good.
They're expanding into Atlanta.
Because nobody leaves Santa Barbara once they get there.
No one leaves Santa Barbara. And so, you know, I think we've taken a significant step with this practice facility development. We're working on a D-League team. We have a couple other significant projects that we're working on. You know, so many people love living in the city of Atlanta. It's expanding rapidly. We think Atlanta is an incredible market. And we have a ton of positive momentum. And Dwight just happens to be kind of born and raised in Atlanta. And so the timing just worked. I don't know that we look at this as anything other than, you know, trying to bring a really good player into a kind of an exploding market with hopefully what we as an organization believe is a growing organization, you know, a first-class organization that's ready to take on and accept a player like Dwight. And so, you know, we're certainly going to embrace the family. We got a great family room, and, you know, we can't wait to have the Howard family as a part of that. But, you know, as to how it works out, again, it's going to be the same old Hawks. We're going to come to work. We're going to try to improve. We're going to try to help Dwight improve. We're going to try to, you know, defend, play unselfishly. Ultimately, we think that'll win games, and we just are so fortunate to be doing it in the incredible city of Atlanta.
Well, Wes, I appreciate you stopping by here. If I can borrow some Marriott points, you know, down the line, I'd appreciate it.
Anytime, helpful.
Chris. Appreciate it, Wes.
It's the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
Welcome back. Another episode of the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. We are here at the Thomas and Mack Center on the concourse and joined here by Tim Bontemps of the Washington Post, Mr. Summer League, as they know him around here. You're like a Summer League legend, Tim.
I'm more like Mr. Chris Mannix podcast / radio show guest. I'm your permanent fill-in guy at this point.
You are a frequent guest here of the Vertical Podcast.
It's a good place to be.
It is. I like to think so.
I'm all right with it.
So we're winding down Summer League
right
towards the end. And, you know, the name of Summer League is Ben Simmons. And he's whoever he wants to talk about. He's ESPN broadcasting these events and NBA TV broadcasting these events. You've got a lot of Ben Simmons over the 4 or 5 days of Summer League week. What stands out to you about Ben Simmons? Does he look like, you know, a star in the making, or do you see flaws?
I think it's the same stuff, Chris, that we knew coming in here, right? I mean, Ben Simmons is going to be a 10-time All-Star if he ever learns how to shoot. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. He's a phenomenal passer. He's already shown when he gives a little bit of effort on defense, which he didn't really in college, he can defend people. But he's got to learn how to shoot. And if he can't convince teams to really guard him, and make him, you know, and think about him as a shooter, you know, his upside, you know, he'll still be a good player, I think, so he can do so many things, but, you know, then maybe he's more of a Lamar Odom level player instead of a transcendent star. And I think that over the next couple of years, I think that's what we're going to find out, is whether that's something he can develop or not.
And that jump shot, it's broken.
Right.
I mean, there needs to be a complete overhaul. And
right. The Sixers just hired a new shooting coach. I can't remember who it is now. It's a long time guy. He's been around the league. You know, that's what he's going to be doing every day.
Yeah.
Working with Ben.
And look, you know, it all comes down to a guy's willingness to change his jump shot. I mean, Kawhi Leonard, when he came into the league, he did not have a very fundamental jump shot. He got to San Antonio. He started working with Chip Englund. Chip really reinvented that jump shot to a certain degree. And now Kawhi is, you know, kind of a knockdown shooter when he's open
right
from beyond the three-point line. What's going to determine Simmons' ability to go next level, be a superstar, is going to be his willingness to change. He has to have kind of a humbleness to his game to recognize that everything he's done to this point, you might want to throw it all out to some degree. Not the talent, but you know, his skill set.
Yeah, no question. I mean, look, you know this as well as anybody from being around a league, you know, like I have too, you know, there's plenty of guys that wash out of the NBA or don't live up to the potential that they have because they're not willing to listen to what they're told. And, you know, these coaches are getting paid for a reason. People might think these coaches are dumb. None of them are dumb. They're watching the game all the time. They know what these guys have to do. And some guys, you know, like Kawhi is a perfect example. He got told stuff, whether it's by Chip or Pop or whoever, for different parts of his game, and he soaked up everything and did it. There's other guys who get told, hey, you should work on this, you should work on that, and they don't do it, or they don't think they have to. And then those guys are the guys who flame out and wash out of the league, or just don't live up to their expectations. Like, I don't think there's any way Ben Simmons isn't a contributor in a pretty big way in the NBA because he does so many things. But like I said before, to me, it's like he could be a 10-time All-Star if he's willing to do the stuff, like you said, and really accept the coaching he's going to need to improve that shot to get it to where he's a threat.
Yeah, and look, Philadelphia is in a really good place right now. I mean, you know, I hate how they got there, and the last 3 years will live in infamy in 76ers history. But right now, when you look at that team and the quality young depth, now we're hearing, you know, Dario Saric coming over and playing for them, you know, next season. I mean, you know, this is a team that is, especially in the front court, not so much in the back court, but especially the front court, is too deep at a lot of positions with high-level young talent. I mean, you have to be, if you're a Sixers fan, you don't forget how you got here, but you have to be kind of optimistic about what you have here going forward.
No question, man. I mean, between Dario Saric, Ben Simmons, Joel Embiid, Jahlil Okafor, and Nerlens Noel, they got five, you know, starting caliber bigs, and some of those guys have more upside than others, but they're all big talents. And, you know, to me, the Sixers are kind of one of the more interesting teams in the league now. Yeah, Brian Colangelo, kind of an odd move, go on the radio the other day and basically say, we have to trade one of these bigs before the season starts. You don't usually hear GM say something like that, but, you know, they have a lot of talent. Now they have to figure out how to try to get their roster optimized to where they kind of have some more balance, because now, like, Sam Hinkie's vision, to your point, has kind of been realized, where now they have all these guys now playing, except they've got five guys kind of like the Kings that all can't dribble the ball, and you know, they have to try to figure out what to do.
Yeah, they need a point guard in the worst way. And
I was selfishly hoping they were going to end up with Chris Dunn in the draft. Like, when there was those talks about getting that third pick from the Celtics, I just thought it made all the sense in the world. They could use some of their assets and give up Okafor or somebody to get that third pick and get Dunn. All of a sudden, you got Simmons and Dunn, and then you got those bigs, and you're in pretty good shape. But
well, they tried. I mean,
they tried to
move into that, three area, but I don't think Brian Colangelo was willing to trade either his pick next year or the Laker pick a year after that to get it. And I don't blame him for that. I mean, the Lakers,
I don't either.
They figured to be a bad team. The Sixers, no matter what, are not going to be a playoff team. They're probably going to be a top five or top six worst team in basketball. But I, you know, the way Chris Dunn has played in this summer league, the brief flashes I saw of him before he got hurt, you know, he looks like a player. I mean, everything you saw at Providence from Chris Dunn, you're seeing right now. Everything you saw at workouts for Chris Dunn, you're seeing right now. He plays with a confidence. He's big. He's kind of built in that Westbrook, John Wall, Derrick Rose type of mold. I mean, this guy has got all the tools to be a great player. I mean, Minnesota's got something here. You plug Chris Dunn to that lineup alongside Wiggins, alongside Karl Towns. I know Tom Thibodeau doesn't love, you know, the idea of building slowly because he wants to win. He's obsessed with winning all the time. But, man, you give this team 2 years, you're in the playoffs. 3 years, you might be competing for something, even in a conference with, a team as tough as Golden State.
Well, to me, the name that I've thought of ever since I saw Chris Dunn live for the first time, which was at the Columbus Regional, not this past spring, but the one before, was Dwayne Wade. Like, he reminds me of a lefty Dwayne Wade. And even in that, the way they kind of came into the league, where, you know, Dunn's an older rookie, played 3 years at Providence. You know, Wade obviously came in after a couple years at Marquette. It wasn't one of the, you know, one and done guys. And I think he's a hell of a talent. And to your point, you know, I've been on record, I think Minnesota's going to win 50 games this year, which might be a little aggressive, but you look at that young group they've got. You know, let's assume for now they keep Ricky Rubio. Karl Towns, I think, is going to be a first-team All-NBA center next season. You've got Wiggins. You've got Zach LaVine. Now you have Chris Dunn. You got Gorgui Dieng. They have some, you know, I thought signing Cole Aldrich was a nice depth piece. Like, they, you know, to your point about Tom, when he got hired this spring, I think a lot of people thought that they might rush out and just spend a ton of money to try to get good right away. And I thought it was interesting that, you know, I think they wanted Luol Deng. When his price got a little too high, when the Lakers gave him 4 for $72, I think they said, go take your money there. But I think they've done a nice job of not trying to just jump in and get a bunch of vets that can help them win now and maybe not in a couple of years. And I think they're real well set up to do, like you said, and really grow and turn into a monster out west.
Yeah, they're in a conference with a big-time monster. And
right. That
has been a topic of conversation here in Las Vegas. The NBA Board of Governors meeting was in Las Vegas. Adam Silver spoke after it. He was pretty clear that he is against, you know, he thinks that Durant going to Golden State is bad for the league. You know, he made that pretty clear in his public comments. Privately, you know, executives have told me the same thing. What are people in these gyms telling you opinion-wise about, you know, what they think of what happened in Golden State this summer?
Get ready for a lockout. I mean, that's what everybody's saying. You know, like, do I think that the NBA is going to lose games next season? I don't think they'll lose games. Because really, you could have a lockout till October 1st and start the season on time, you know, and get everything out of the way. But I think between the amount of money that got spent this summer and the guys who got paid that people didn't think should get paid the way they did, and the fact that the Warriors are able to put together this super team without having to break up their superstar core of Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, and Draymond Green, you know, it brings a lot of memories back from 2010, even though the circumstances are different. When the Heat came together a year later, the CBA came up and there was an extended lockout, and the league dug in and wanted to really put in some draconian measures to try to prevent this from happening again. And I would not be at all surprised if, you know, a year from now, we're not here in Vegas, we're in New York, and we're talking about hard caps and franchise tags and percentage points of basketball-related income, and we're stuck right in the middle of that mess again.
Well, that's a word I've heard, or two words I've heard a couple of times, franchise tag. And you better believe that the smaller market teams, particularly a team like Oklahoma City, which, you know, they are now the cautionary tale for all this. Even before anything is resolved when it comes to Russell Westbrook, there is a high likelihood that in the span of 4 years, they're going to lose three top 15 level players. And to not have a franchise tag to use on a player like Kevin Durant, I think that's something they'll really be among the smaller market teams pushing pretty hard for that. And when you combine that with the fact that up until, you know, the last couple of months, one of the things I was consistently hearing was about how the union was going to get theirs. Like, they want to get their piece of the pie back. You know, they got largely clobbered. I think the NBA hates when I say this, but they got largely clobbered. They got clobbered in the negotiations. You have a new head of the executive director in Michelle Roberts. She's got to make her mark. You have elite players more involved with this process than ever before.
Yep.
So I think this all barrels towards a work stoppage. And where I disagree with you is I think we are headed towards losing games. I think...
Don't get me wrong.
No, when you have you know, this many high-profile guys involved, determined to get theirs. Look, I don't blame, you know, a guy like LeBron and Russell Westbrook and Kevin Durant and players of that ilk, Steph Curry, they deserve to be paid $40 million a year. They do, because in the NBA, stars drive revenue. They drive ticket sales. They drive television viewership. They drive you know, merchandise sales. They earn north of $40 million per year. So if they hold out and say, whoa, I want to make sure I get paid what I'm worth in this market, I don't blame them, because I think they are technically worth it.
No, there's no question they're worth it. I mean, stars in the NBA are worth more than any other sport because there's so few players on the court. One guy can dramatically impact things. I mean, look, LeBron James has led teams to the NBA Finals 6 years in a row for a reason. You know, if you have one guy who's that good, he can change everything. And he should be paid probably $100 million a year, frankly. And I think, you know, the idea of a max salary is probably something that's going to come up. Because you look at, you know, not to pick on him, but a guy like Harrison Barnes, right? He gets a max contract this year solely because there's a max number. And he is, you know, he's a wing and he can do some things and he's a young guy. And so he fits a certain profile. And so he gets a max contract. And, you know, I've had multiple people say to me this week, like, why wouldn't the owners want to lock out when you look at some of the money that these guys have gotten? But the problem is, from the union side, you know, even though, like, Michelle Roberts has said, you know, we might want to get rid of the max salary and the executive committee is full of stars. If you get rid of the max salary, you're killing 90% of the union. Because those artificial caps are in for those star guys, the money trickles down to everybody else. So even something like that, that maybe the stars would want and the league would definitely want, because they'd much rather pay Russell Westbrook $60 million than pay Enes Kanter and Deion Waiters and Andre Roberson $45 million combined, you know. But it's going to be an interesting discussion. The only thing that I think might save us from losing games is there is so much damn money in this system now, and this TV contract is so damn big. I just don't know if both sides are going to really let money go off the table when everybody's making so much.
Well, they would both get buried,
right?
And
everybody would get killed then.
Get killed, because while they're arguing over how to split a multi-billion-dollar pie,
right.
You will have all these anecdotal stories coming up of support staff losing their job.
Yep.
Ticket sellers losing their jobs.
Yep.
I mean, all this, you know, that's where the human interest stuff is where they get buried on.
Yeah.
When you have, and every year, it happened during the last lockout. I don't think it got as much publicity in the last lockout as it might this time around. But you will hear story after story about people in hard luck situations because they don't have the NBA
right.
You know, provided jobs
wow, these, you know, millionaires and billionaires are, and I sound like Bernie Sanders there.
No, but it's true. Well, here, the problem was last time, the reason the league got away with it and so, as much as they did last time was because they could argue teams were losing money, and they were right. Like, they had some teams that were losing money. Nobody's losing money anymore. So they can't, if they're going to start laying people off to say, well, we want to make more money, like, that ain't going to fly with anybody. If you could say, well, we were already losing games before, so now we can't afford to keep these people, that was a crap argument to begin with, but at least you could make the argument. If everybody's making money now, what are you going to say? Well, we just want to make more money. Well, that doesn't fly. So I definitely don't want to be covering a lockout next July, but just it, especially this Durant move really does feel like the final nail in the coffin, where you look around and you see how things are developing, and you see, you know, you already can start seeing the marching orders coming out. You have Adam Silver, you know, saying that, you know, we think the system can be improved. As you, to your point, which I think hasn't really been played up enough, Michelle Roberts needs to stake out her territory, and she's been a firebrand from the start about wanting to fight for things. And look, the union lost 7 BRI points last time. Like, they went from 57 to 50. So, I mean, they want to go back somewhere in the middle or higher. And so it is a depressing thing when you think about how much excitement and energy there is around the league right now. All the young stars here, we just came off this great finals, we're probably going to have it again. You know, the league's maybe never been in a better place, and yet here we are still talking about this nonsense is going to happen here.
Yeah, and people do forget that when Michelle Roberts took the job, she did a series of interviews that rattled the NBA.
Yeah, talked to both of us about it.
She
different
did.
Times.
She, it rattled the NBA because it was public saber rattling by Michelle Roberts that indicated strongly on her part,
yep,
that there was a divide that was almost impossible to close
right
in by 2017.
Yeah, she's
now
putting everybody on notice.
Now you have you know, a situation where the union wants something big, the NBA is going to want something big. It shakes out to be almost unavoidable at this point, in my opinion.
No, I totally agree. Totally agree. Like you said, if both sides are going to want enough, that I think at least for a while we're gonna have some issues, and maybe they get to September, and maybe they get it done before they have to start losing games to save that money. But I wouldn't be surprised if we do lose games either, because like you said, people are pretty dug in on each side, and there's no reason to think that they're gonna move anytime soon.
Now, when you look at player transactions here, and I want to talk about what the Celtics have. I know you wrote about them and you saw them, but you know, are still, you know, names in the water supply. People are wondering if there's going to be a big name being moved. You continue to hear the name of DeMarcus Cousins. You hear Kevin Love, even though they won a championship, his name in circulation. You're still wondering if the Bulls are going to hold on to Jimmy Butler at this point. Jahlil Okafor, we talked about Philly. He's the most likely guy to be moved. Do you think we're done with big moves at this point, or do you think there might still be another shoe to drop?
Nah, there's going to be. I mean, look, we both know Sam Presti pretty well. I would bet that Russell Westbrook's on another team by the start of the season. You know, Sam in his time has established a pretty clear track record of when he sees a situation where he's going to lose somebody for nothing, he moves on. Now, Kevin Durant was obviously a different situation. The Thunder thought they were keeping him basically until Sunday afternoon before July 4th, when he, you know, everyone kind of started to figure out he was going to leave. But
they did the right thing there, though.
No, and yeah, you're right. You have to go to the wall with him and try to keep him. But once he leaves, Russell Westbrook doesn't want to do an extension with them right now. It just seems like that's an inevitable move. I think you're right about Jahlil Okafor. You know, the fact that Colangelo said publicly they got to move somebody, he's the obvious guy to move there. And you know, I had heard back in June that, you know, DeMarcus Cousins was on the market maybe as much as he's ever been. Now, they're obviously in a unique situation. Sacramento, Vivek Ranadive, the owner, is a very mercurial guy. He can go from one side to the other in 5 minutes. So is he going to actually sign off on a Cousins trade? Remains to be seen. But, you know, I certainly think that as time goes on out there in Sacramento, you know, you look at that clock starts to tick now, right? We've got 2 years left on his contract for DeMarcus. Every day he's there, you think his value goes down. And if they don't get off to a better start this year, you know, he's a guy maybe at the deadline in February that you could definitely see move.
Yeah, I think every day his value does go down. Because when you have 2 years to kind of break him of the Sacramento,
kind of the sweet spot, too. You know, 2 years on the contract, too.
We use Sacramento as kind of a verb here. You know, the break him of the Sacramento
right.
In him that, you know, I mean, I think that makes him valuable. And I really believe that Cousins in a winning situation is a different player. I mean, he may not be perfect, but he has been like, think about how long he's been part of that Sacramento dysfunction. I mean, he dates back to the Maloofs, right? I mean, he goes all the way back to the origins of the dysfunction. How many coaches has he gone through? How many trades and roster overhauls?
Yeah. I've always compared DeMarcus to Rasheed Wallace, where he's probably always never going to quite live up to what he probably should talent-wise, because he is like Rasheed, it's an immense talent. But I think that he'll end up in a situation like Rasheed did in Detroit at some point in his career, where the right pieces are around him and he's in the right environment, it clicks, and he's a monster on a really good team. I don't know if Boston would make sense like that. A lot of places he could wind up where that could happen. But I feel like at some point in his career, whether he gets traded or if he leaves as a free agent, he's going to find himself in a situation where he can kind of have that Rasheed-like run for 5 or 6 years with a really good team and really do a lot of damage.
All right, let's talk about Boston, a team that has a whole bunch of young assets. Feels like we say this every year, that holds a whole bunch of young assets, but maybe even more this year is that you've got Jaylen Brown, a top three pick. You've got a bunch of young draft picks that you just made. Plus, you've got Brooklyn's pick next year. And I'm not sure there's a team in basketball right now that projects to be as bad as the Brooklyn Nets. I mean, they're bad.
They're really bad.
Then you get their pick in 2018, which may not be that much better. I mean, the Celtics are in a position where they can make a deal. But let me ask you this first. Jaylen Brown picked ahead of Chris Dunn, and that was some controversy at the time. What did you see out of him during Summer League week?
I wouldn't have done that. I would have taken Dunn, but I like Jaylen Brown. He's an interesting guy, really smart kid. I talked to Brad Stevens after their game yesterday. They lost late to Cleveland, but the thing that Brad mentioned, and you could see it in the game, was that Brown tried to take the game over. I think he had 25 and 9, and you could see he was really trying to will them to a win late, which is nice. Like, you here at Summer League, as you know, you really want to see these guys with the most talent, you know, these one or two star guys on each team. This is an opportunity for them to really take ownership of something. And it was good to see him do something like that. But to your point about their roster, you know, yeah, the Celtics have all these picks and they have all these guys, but this is kind of what I wrote about with them. Like, at some point, they got to start making some moves. Like, I know how Danny Ainge operates, and I know he doesn't like to make a trade unless he's getting the house from somebody. I understand that. But at some point, like, they've got just so many guys now. They've almost got too many guys. And if you don't make a move and you have all these guys and all these picks coming in with more guys, at some point you're just going to start reducing the value of the assets you've got because you just have too many and people know you have to start doing something.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they need another star. Like, they got Al, which is big, Al Horford, but they still need to go get somebody else.
Yeah. I mean, and that's a team that even if you couldn't get – if you had an opportunity to trade for Russell Westbrook – even if you couldn't get a commitment from him long term, I would roll the dice. I really would.
Oh, I think they should too.
I think Westbrook is that type of transcendent player. And I can tell you what I know about Boston and players' reactions to playing there, it's that they don't always want to go there at first. But when they get there, they're pretty
comfortable. Once they get there.
It's a combination of, you know, you've had Doc Rivers first, then you had Brad Stevens. So you got great coaching there. Danny Ainge can relate to players and he's done a great job at building that team. The fan base is as strong as any in sports. So I feel like if you get Westbrook there and you win, and with Westbrook, they're probably a 55-win team next year, depending on what they have to give up from the actual roster. But, you know, you give him that, put him in the Eastern Conference where Cleveland might be in flux in the coming years, I think you've got a great shot at convincing him. Plus, how much money would Russell lose? Especially if Boston has his rights, and we talked about the lockout.
Right.
If Boston has his rights and they say franchise tag for every player,
right,
all of a sudden Russell has to stay. So, it's a big risk to take, no question, but that's the kind of guy I would roll the dice on.
That's why I think the Lakers should trade. Like, to me, I think Sam Presti's going to hold out for a lot, as you would expect for him. If I'm the Lakers and then Sam Presti calls me and say, gives me Russell and Ingram for him, I'd do it. Because, A, I don't think a team like the Lakers is going to necessarily get a meeting with Russell Westbrook because they stink. And the other thing is, I think teams have to think, to your point, about what's coming with this lockout and whether they get rid of max salaries or they institute a franchise tag or something like that. There's probably going to be an even bigger advantage to be the incumbent team now to have a guy like that on your roster. So I'm with you. If you can get a top five player in the league or a top seven player in the league, you go get him. And you take the chance on it because you could have five picks in a row in the top five in the draft, and you may never draft a guy that's an all-star. And if you can go get a guy that you know is going to be a superstar right now, you do it. You worry about the rest later.
So you're not going to Rio, so you're soft.
That's right.
You're saying. You don't really work that hard.
I don't.
No. I mean, that's disappointing.
Yeah,
work
well,
harder.
We all can't be Chris Mannix and have 75 jobs and be running around all the
that's
time.
That's true.
You're not even going to cover basketball in Rio.
That's true. I'm not doing that either, but I'm looking forward to that trip. All right, Tim, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it.
Sure, man. Anytime.
Thanks for listening, and thanks to my guests, Wes Wilcox of the Atlanta Hawks and Tim Bontemps of the Washington Post. Check this podcast out on iTunes, and when you do, give us a decent rating and leave a comment if you can. You can also download us on TuneIn, Stitcher, Art19.com, really anywhere you can download podcasts. Once there, you can get the Vertical Podcast with Woj and the Vertical Podcast with JJ Redick as well. The NBA may be slowing down, but we won't. We'll see you next week.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.